Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the former head of CIA's Osama bin Laden unit, what to do about a surge in al-Qaeda. But first, the stock market roller coaster ride seems to have hit some higher ground today. It's up after suffering a 460-point drop yesterday, the biggest decline since 9/11. Overall, U.S. markets fell about 3% yesterday. Global markets started slumping after Shanghai's financial market dropped 9%. Shanghai rallied today, rising 3%, and today Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke told Congress that financial markets appear to be working well. Well, joining us on the line is Mark Zandi, Chief Economist at Moody's Economy.com. Mark, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke told the House Budget Committee markets are running smoothly. This was just a normal market correction. Other analysts today have said the word correction means we tanked. What's your interpretation?
Well, we did tank. 3% is a big move in a very short period of time. But markets are functioning well. They're up again this morning. And it feels like a what you might call a garden variety correction, at least to this point.
And but what do you mean by that, garden variety?
Well, the market had moved straight up for more than 12 months. Before yesterday's decline, it was up over 15%. So that's a big move in a very short period of time. So it's not unusual for markets to take a step back after such big gains. And yesterday was that step back.
Right. Well, we also heard today that analysts such as yourself would be eyeing this report from the on the GDP. It measures the values of all goods and services produced within the United States. It came out today. It showed that the economy grew slower than originally predicted in the last quarter of last year. The rate was 2.2%. The estimate was 3.5%. So your sense of that, is that cause for concern for you?
No, it's pretty close to expectations. The economy is growing slowly, but to some degree that's by design. The Federal Reserve tightened monetary policy for 2-3 years in an effort to slow growth, to take the edge off inflation, and that's exactly what they're getting. Now, this is a tricky time when the economy is growing slowly like it is. You know, things can go wrong. Yesterday's market correction is a good case in point. So it's a tricky period, but so far so good. The economy is sticking to script. It's slow growth, but that's exactly what policymakers like to see.
It may not be good news for house sellers, but apparently a really good time to buy a house because housing is one of the areas that's in trouble. But that's, you know, again, good for home buyers.
Yeah, that's right. The softest part of the economy still remains the housing market. It's been correcting for a year and a half. It's in full swing. Got another read on that today. New home sales plunged in January and prices fell. And you're right. It makes life difficult for sellers, but it makes life very, very good for buyers. And I think once buyers feel more comfortable that prices hit bottom probably sometime this summer or later this year, then they'll start going back into the market and buying again.
Well, we want to get you to weigh in on yesterday's downturn in the global markets. It's being partially credited to, blamed on the steep decline in the Shanghai market. That was, as we said, about 9%. First of all, why did that happen in Shanghai, and why would that have such a quick and violent reverberation?
It happened because the Chinese market's highly speculative. There was a lot of buying in that very thin market, felt much like the Y2K period here in the U.S. When everyone was piling into the market and just buying for no reason, but just because prices were rising. So it's not too surprising that we saw a correction there. It had an impact here because China is such an important part of now the global economy, accounts for about 10% of global growth. And if the Chinese economy stumbles, then so will the entire global economy, including our own. So we need to keep a close eye on that market and that economy.
And we want to check in with you further on Ben Bernanke's comments today on Capitol Hill. He testified about the deficit. He said if policy changes aren't made now, there have to be drastic consequences. He said draconian responses, and he focused mostly on the rising costs of Social Security and Medicaid, if changes aren't made. What sort of draconian measures might we see in the future?
Well, we probably see very sharp cuts in the entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, may even see some tax increases, and financial markets may be very upset if budget deficits continue to rise. And I think the chairman is right. It's not a problem. The deficit isn't a problem today. It's not a problem next year, but it will be our most significant economic problem probably for the next president, and we're going to have to tackle that. If we don't, then we will have a financial, not a financial correction like we did yesterday, but we'll have a financial crisis.
Mark Zandi, Chief Economist at MoodysEconomy.com. Mark, thanks as always.
Thank you.
In an about turn, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is saying the U.S. will attend a conference in Iraq next month with Iraq's neighbors, including Iran. Good news for those pushing for diplomacy in that part of the world. But is Iraq the biggest problem in that part of the world? Former CIA analyst Michael Scheuer says the real threat is terrorists regrouping in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And further, he says someday they are going to detonate a nuclear device inside the United States. Well, Scheuer is the previously anonymous author of Imperial Hubris. Before 9/11, he headed the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit. He left the CIA in 2004. After two decades with the agency, and since then he's been a prominent critic of how the U.S. has fought terrorism in this and previous administrations, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Condoleezza Rice's statement. What do you make of this idea? Officials have said there were going to be no talks until Iran gave up its nuclear enrichment program. Now they're saying they're going to meet with Syria and Iran.
Well, this administration, I think, is just desperate. They're losing wars in two places. They're losing in Iraq. They're losing in Afghanistan. And they're just at sixes and sevens about what to do. The idea that they're now going to reach out to the Iranians, I think, is nothing more than a sign of their desperation.
Well, some would say it's a sign of strength, recognizing that diplomacy is the way to go in the region.
Well, if anybody really believes that the Iranians are going to settle for anything less than a Shia-dominated Iraq, I think they've got another thing coming. Or that the Saudis and the other Sunni states will put up with a Shia state. There's going to be a long, drawn-out regional civil war in that country. And all this administration is doing is looking for a way to, at least in their own eyes, evacuate Iraq with some kind of decorum.
Well, picking up there, it reminds us, we've wanted to ask you, Al-Qaeda, which is your main interest, is a largely Sunni group. Iran, as you said, largely Shia. What is the relationship between Osama bin Laden and Iran?
They're generally at daggers drawn. Bin Laden has no love for the Shia. He just wants to fight them last, after he defeats the United States and after they try to destroy the Saudi government and the Israelis and the Kuwaitis. The Iranians, on the other hand, have a very intense dislike of bin Laden and have reached, the two of them have reached kind of a point where they are wary of each other and basically steer clear. And the Iranians have a bit of an upper hand at the moment because they hold two of bin Laden's sons and several other of his senior officials under house arrest in Iran. They have been there now for 3 or 4 years.
Huh. Well, yeah, in fact, you write that Al-Qaeda values Iraq primarily for the entree it gives them into Jordan, Syria, into Turkey. But does that dislike of Al-Qaeda by Iran and vice versa, does that maybe play into the U.S.'s hands right now? Is that possibly, given what you and others are talking about, the buildup of Al-Qaeda on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, does this possible rapprochement in a month in Iraq, is that perhaps a smart move in the fight against Al-Qaeda?
Only if we persuade the Iranians to turn over the people they have in custody in Tehran. Otherwise, I don't see too much of an advantage to it. The war in Iraq will go on. The war in Afghanistan will continue.
Huh. Well, turning to Al-Qaeda on the Afghan-Pakistan border, media reports have said that Al-Qaeda has reformed, this time with new training camps in Pakistan. So first, to a claim you've made for several years, is Al-Qaeda getting closer to the point that members can explode a nuclear device in the U.S.? And if so, why do you think they haven't done it yet?
Well, I don't think I don't think my opinion matters on this. I think what matters is the fact that they've gone to an extraordinary amount of trouble to tell us they're going to do it, and to tell us that they have religious authorization to kill 10 million Americans. To me, that's the beginning of wisdom, to listen to what the enemy says. There's a pretty good correlation between what they say and what they do. But the most serious reason I believe it's going to happen is because we have utterly failed under the last three administrations to complete securing the Soviet nuclear arsenal. And again, that's not my opinion. That's the statement by the people who run the program that's supposed to secure those weapons. We know Al-Qaeda wants to do it. We know it has unlimited money as far as purchasing something. We know that our borders are open, and we know the weapons aren't secured. The answer why they haven't done it, I don't know. Maybe they haven't bought it yet.
And if it does happen, a horrible scenario, how should the U.S. respond?
Well, there's really no rational response. I think if it happened, say, tomorrow, what we would do is annihilate the Iranians, because it's somebody out there to blame.
But you just said the Iranians have nothing to do with al-Qaeda.
Yeah, but I don't think it would have any difference. I don't think it would make any difference to this administration or to any administration, because there's nothing to respond to. If al-Qaeda detonates a weapon in this country and claims it, what do we do?
Well, some would say if we know Osama bin Laden is on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, that's where you attack.
Okay, what do you do, though? If you're going to go in there, you need 500,000 men or more. Or do you use an atomic weapon to try to just kill everybody in the area, hoping you get him? It's a very unusual historical position. It may be a unique instance in history where the world's greatest power, if it's attacked, has nothing to respond against that makes rational sense. We will have to respond. And if it would happen today, the Iranians, I think, would be on the guillotine. But if it happens down the road, and we know it's not the Iranians, what else do we do?
Well, and let's stay with that. How does the U.S. fight this war? This week, the war of words, at least, seems to be against Pakistan. We know Vice President Dick Cheney making a trip there, saying Pakistan isn't doing enough to fight the al-Qaeda threat on the border. We know Pakistan made a deal with warlords in the Waziristan area a year ago and withdrew troops. Some have been very, very critical of President Musharraf for doing that. You, however, you say, let me quote you, I don't see how anyone can say they are not genuine in their efforts, meaning the Pakistanis. Make your case.
Well, no one has done more to help the American war against al-Qaeda and the Taliban than the Pakistanis, and especially Musharraf. He's helped us arrest dozens of senior al-Qaeda people in his cities. He's given us an expanded presence in his country and overflight rights. And he sent his army three times up into the border area, where they got beat three times, by the way. None of that is in the national interests of Pakistan. Neither al-Qaeda nor the Taliban posed a threat to Pakistan before 9/11. And so for us to keep pounding on Musharraf to do more simply puts him in the position of saying, you know, the Americans are not serious about this. They have a skeleton force in Afghanistan. They've been there for almost 6 years. They're losing the insurgency. You know, again, what more can Musharraf do and not destabilize his country? Cheney went there because, again, as Ms. Rice and Iran, we are desperate to find somebody else to pull our chestnuts out of the fire.
Michael Scheuer, he's the former head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. By the way, Michael also says that he agrees with New Yorker writer Seymour Hersh, who wrote this week that the U.S. is prepared to bomb Iran on 24-hour notice. And Seymour Hersh also wrote that the U.S. is funneling money without congressional oversight to groups in the Middle East to try to counter Iran, but some of that money is going to al-Qaeda. So what to do about al-Qaeda? We'll have more with Michael Scheuer after a quick break. Also, this reminder later, we'll speak to a religious scholar on those claims that Jesus is not risen, but remains buried in Jerusalem. Back in a minute here and now. It's here and now. Later today, the perils of being a foreign documentary filmmaker following in the footsteps of Borat. But first, we're back with terrorism expert Michael Scheuer. He's the former head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit and author of the books Imperial Hubris and Through Our Enemy's Eyes. He was just telling us about how no nation has done more than Pakistan to help the U.S. in its fight against al-Qaeda. But Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf says the U.S. needs more troops in Afghanistan to fight terrorists there. And Michael, you write, how can the U.S. expect to do with 40,000 troops what the Soviet Union couldn't do with 150,000 troops? Now, the U.S. arguably also has more Afghan allies than the Soviets did. Will any number of troops work in Afghanistan?
Only if you go there for the specific reason of applying punishment. We made the mistake of going there to build a secular democratic government in a conservative Islamic country dominated by tribes. The mission itself was implausible, close to ridiculous. Our only mission in Afghanistan was to get in there and destroy as much of al-Qaeda and the Taliban as we could, and we didn't do that. We didn't send enough troops. We won the cities and declared victory. We left the border open, so Taliban and Al-Qaeda all escaped, and now they're coming back again.
You're talking about 2002, and you've said this, that at that time, troops, U.S. troops were pulled out. They were already being grouped to go to Iraq.
Yes. By the summer of 2002, at least at CIA, we were giving up officers to prepare for Iraq. It was very clear that that's what was happening. And they were taking special forces out of Afghanistan and retraining them to go to Iraq.
Well, given that, what happens now? If you're saying that the U.S. didn't stay in Afghanistan long enough to, as you say, secure the borders, really make sure that the threat of Al-Qaeda was suppressed and the Taliban was removed, that the U.S. should have stayed longer, apply that same thinking to Iraq.
Well, I think we should have stayed shorter in Afghanistan. What I was trying to argue was that we had no hope of rebuilding that country or establishing a democracy there. That's a fool's errand. In Iraq, basically all we had to do is, if we wanted to go in at all, which I think was a mistake, was to destroy Saddam's government and get out.
Yeah, but how, what do you do with the opposing thought, which is you can't just create a vacuum and leave, because into that vacuum would come Al-Qaeda.
Well, they're there now, aren't
right.
they? They weren't, the two greatest allies we had were Saddam Hussein and the Assads in Syria in terms of Islamist expansion westward from South Asia. They were the cork in the neck of the bottle. And we destroyed both of them. Now we have a cauldron in Iraq, which is going to be a flow-through toward the Levant in Turkey, the Arabian Peninsula. And at the end of the day, we've just created a horrendous mess for ourselves.
Well, a terrible note to leave it on, Michael Scheuer, and maybe I'm going to make it worse by asking this question. We've been focusing on the Afghan border with Pakistan, the pursuit for Osama bin Laden. Does it even matter anymore if Osama bin Laden is captured? Is he the mastermind behind the Al-Qaeda movement?
Sure. He remains in control of Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is the one entity on this earth that can attack us within the United States and who we can't deter. We don't need really to be afraid of the Iranians or the North Koreans or anyone else in terms of attacking us inside the continental United States. But as long as bin Laden is alive and controls Al-Qaeda, they're working, you can count on it, to attack us inside America. And so it's very important to find him and kill him. So you don't want to capture him. But you do want to kill him as quickly as you can.
Why is that?
Why don't we want to capture him?
Well, yeah, and bring him to trial.
No, that falls into the kind of American mindset of cops and robbers. You don't want to put someone who is eloquent as he is on television for 3 years and let him talk to the Arab world from the Southern District of New York.
Yeah,
I think we should have learned our lesson with the soldier who should have thrown a grenade in with Saddam. You just want these people dead. You don't want them on trial.
You absolutely know what you're sounding like. You absolutely know, as you said, that the American mindset is that that's what we're about. I mean, that's what democracy is about, that people should be tried and our
well,
system.
For crimes, yes, but not for war. We're at war, and what Clinton and what this president has done and what the first Mr. Bush has done is to try to describe this business as a law enforcement exercise conducted outside the United States. And for that reason, we're losing two wars, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq. We assume there's so few of these people, somehow we can bring them to justice one at a time. And that on the face of it is absurd, but that's the operating premise of our government.
Mm-hmm. Is that also why the thinking is that Pakistan, in all likelihood, would never turn over Osama bin Laden to the U.S.?
Yeah, the reason Pakistan will never turn over Osama bin Laden is because it's not in their interest to do so. We don't like to admit it, but bin Laden is the hero of the Sunni Islamic world. And to turn him over would cause all kinds of problems for Musharraf's political stability, the political stability of Pakistan. And we should have known that going in.
And Michael Scheuer, since you've been so critical of the pursuit of Osama bin Laden, how would you do it? What's not happening that you would want to see happen?
Well, you certainly don't have enough people there to do it.
How many people would it take?
Well, as I said, the Soviets couldn't do it with 150,000. I don't think we could do it with less than 250,000. And we'd have to go into Pakistan. It's a very difficult game at the moment. Had we killed him when we had the chance, it would have been different. Right now, it's very difficult to do. Most of our military and intelligence officers spend their days trying to protect Mr. Karzai's government against the Taliban. We don't have a lot of resources left to go after Osama bin Laden.
Wait, are you saying that's the only way to get Osama bin Laden, 250,000 troops?
Well, you have to have enough troops to, one, hold Afghanistan, which we don't have at the moment, and, B, you have to have enough surplus people to do a little bit more, a great deal more, looking for bin Laden.
Terrorism expert Michael Scheuer, the former head of the CIA's bin Laden unit and author of the books Imperial Hubris and Through Our Enemy's Eyes. Michael, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
You're welcome, ma'am.
And a quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Is America ready for a Mormon president? Mitt Romney hopes so, but we'll speak with a professor who says it could be a tough sell. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, researchers point out there was more than one Jesus in Jerusalem. So who was buried in that crypt? That's still ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here. It's Here and Now. Is Jesus buried in a suburb of Jerusalem? As you've probably heard, the claim that Jesus wasn't physically resurrected is made in the new James Cameron documentary airing on the Discovery Channel Sunday. The film, The Lost Tomb of Jesus, says the burial boxes found in this tomb years ago are inscribed with the names Jesus, Mary, Mary Magdalene, Matthew, Joseph, and Judah, and that, in fact, Judah was the son sired by Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Well, so what to make of all of this? At least to one researcher, not much. Journalist Bruce Feiler is author of Walking the Bible and Where God Was Born in Abraham. Bruce, welcome back. We should say none of us have seen this film, but tell us, what do you make of this claim?
Well, I think if you're going to stand up in a darkened room in a press conference in a hidden location and announce to the world that one of the pillars of Western civilization is false, it's certainly going to be provocative, but you better have the evidence to back it up. And I think that, you know, the first thing to say here is that the evidence is very sketchy. Actually, maybe really the first thing to say is there's nothing new in the idea that every few years someone stands up and kind of makes a claim of this kind. I mean, if you go back 200 years, 99% of the people on the planet, if you will, believed that the Bible was real. And in the last two centuries, we've seen this kind of great tension, wrestling match between science and the Bible. And pretty much whatever is the scientific breakthrough of the moment becomes the battlefield on which the war between science and the Bible is waged. So 150 years ago, you had Darwin and evolution. Now you've got DNA, and that was the most explosive claim that they made, that DNA proved that this was Jesus and that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and that they together sired a child.
And what would you say to that claim?
They don't really have the DNA evidence to back that up, because what they did with the DNA is they tried to determine if there was relations between the various bones in the cave. And let me just kind of just give a little background. Essentially, in this time period, the first century BCE and the first century of the Common Era, bodies were buried in caves, and it was a Jewish custom, of course, as it still is, to bury the body within 24 hours. One of the challenges we have here is that how would this family from Nazareth have been buried in Jerusalem where you can't get a body in 24 hours? Then you'd come back a year later, and you would take the bones and put the bones into one of these stone burial boxes called an ossuary. What Avner Gorin, my archaeologist companion, said to me on Monday when I talked to him about this is you have Greek individualism kind of arising in the region at this time, and that's why for the first time you began to label the boxes. And what the DNA research that these people did, I kind of hesitate to call them scholars, indicated that the bones labeled Jesus were not related matrilinearly.
In other words, they weren't related through
the mother,
right,
to the bones of the woman.
And because of that, they conclude that they must have been husband and wife.
From that, they make the elaborate jump to conclude that they must have been husband and wife. But what we do, there's nothing on this that labels it as a family. In fact, tombs at this time could have been family tombs, could have been communal tombs, could have been neighborhood tombs. There's nothing that indicates the bones of the man and the bones of the woman ever met.
Well,
it could have been of different generations, in fact.
Well, Bruce, just to to play devil's advocate, I realize as I say that, some might be taking that quite literally.
Devil is the advocate here, I guess you could say.
People are reacting because people in modern times are saying, what are the chances that there was a Jesus and a Mary Magdalene and a Joseph, a son of Joseph, I think one of them was called, all in the same cave?
The filmmakers gave this information to a statistician, and the statistician claimed that the odds were 600 to 1. In fact, these names were quite common. Tomb burial ossuaries with the name Jesus have been found all over this neighborhood, and they're claiming that it's 600 to 1, and that is really the backbone of the claim.
You also quote Daryl Bach, a professor at the Conservative Protestant Dallas Seminary, on your blog, asking, why would Jesus' family or followers bury his bones in a family plot and then turn around and preach that he had been physically raised from the dead? Some would say, well, the answer to that is because this is a very important story and legacy to keep alive. Is there any possibility that this is true?
Theories for generations that, in fact, Jesus was tried and he may even have been crucified, but that he was buried, and that's where the story should end, that there is no evidence for the resurrection, and that that was essentially made up by his followers to enhance his reputation and then kind of turned into this religion by Paul. Absolutely, it's possible. And in fact, I don't think, based on what we have in this story, that we can pass judgment on the kind of validity or lack of validity in the story of the resurrection. I think that what we can pass judgment on is whether or not the evidence that these filmmakers are claiming to be evidence that the resurrection did not happen, that this evidence is very, very weak. And to go back to what I said earlier, to stand up in a to the world and say that this proves, remember, this documentary is called The Lost Tomb of Jesus. They are declaring this to be evidence that Christianity is false. I'm not even a Christian, but what I'm saying is that this is what's, I think, really kind of goading about this.
Well, and you write, again, in your blog, that the headline of this story is that the churches have been taken out of the equations and replaced with Hollywood. You started by saying that, you know, there's been this combination of science and media for the last 200 years, you know, coming forth with these great pronouncements. And that's what you see in this story this time. Explain more about that, that churches have been...
I think it's very interesting. If you go back, and archaeology is basically 150 years old. It was invented in the middle of the 19th century, largely actually to dig up the Bible and to dig up the Iliad and the Odyssey. And for, say, 75 years ago, you had this kind of golden triangle among religious institutions, archaeologists, and the press. And the religious institutions, both Christian and Jewish, would pay for these grand digs. The archaeologists would make these grand claims. One of the most famous was Leonard Woolley saying in the 1920s, I found the flood, when in fact it turns out he found a regional flood in Mesopotamia in modern-day Iraq. And then the press would kind of report them credulously because it would, you know, sell newspapers.
And because we all really do want to know the answer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what matters here about this, Robin. What matters here about this is there are lots of people in the world, tens, maybe hundreds of millions of people, who really are struggling to find what is the truth in these stories and what is their relevance to my life. And that is, I've written, as you know, and you and I have talked about this on many occasions, several books about trying to figure out what is the mix of history and what is their relevance to my life today. And I think that what is really has been kind of somewhat upsetting to me about this whole experience is what they're doing is they are preying on the emotions of people not so biblical literate, and so therefore they are kind of easily duped by these false claims. And I think what we have in the wake of Dan Brown is a situation where people understand that kind of lay people out there are now open to the idea that what is written in the Bible was somehow manipulated, that there were gospels left out, there were gospels that were put in, and therefore the Bible doesn't contain the whole story. And I think without the Da Vinci Code, you really wouldn't have this kind of outburst. And I actually think I'm prepared to say there's more truth in Dan Brown's fiction than there is in this fact.
Bruce Feiler, his books do include Walking the Bible, Where is God, Abraham. Are you going to be watching this weekend?
Whenever something takes over the media like this, we all have to watch and we have to point out the flaws, I say. I forgot to mention this. The scholar who actually did the original excavation has declared it nonsense.
This was 27 years ago.
Yeah, and the scholar that they paid to be with them at the press conference said he was highly skeptical. That's the guy on the payroll.
Bruce, thanks as always.
Great to be with you, Robin.
And I guess that's part of the bottom line. We'll be watching. You're listening to Here and Now. Most people would think George Mezzo from Budapest had the perfect job. He produced concerts for a British company that brought Western bands into Eastern Europe. He worked with U2, Pink Floyd, Queen, Sting, pretty much everybody. He hung out with Bono and Freddie Mercury and taught them Hungarian words and phrases. But there was something about his life that made George Mezzo miserable and eventually prompted him to leave his dream job and his country. Here's his story.
In Budapest, I had the life. I had a lot of money. I traveled a lot. I had a cleaning lady coming in. I flew to New York if I wanted to buy clothes or shoes. And not a lot of Hungarians could afford that at the time. There was one thing that really made it sort of unbearable, really. You just can't go anywhere without having to smoke somebody else's cigarette smoke. You can't go out to have dinner. You can't go to a club. You can't go to a concert. You can't go anywhere. It's just disgusting. I ate out at really good restaurants in different cities wherever I worked or went to. And I left without paying several times because I just couldn't finish my dinner. They couldn't either receive me or have the person next to me extinguish his cigarette. When you're out late and you're really tired, you don't always want to have a shower when you get home. You just go into bed and just you know, crash out. But no, you can, because I couldn't sleep because I was smelling my hair and I was smelling my body. Even my body was smelling cigarette smoke. So you have to have a shower. It's just the older I got, I was like, you know what? I don't have to put up with this. There's a place in the world where not only there's no winter, but because I always hated winters and the snow, and you can't smoke anywhere. Southern California, Los Angeles. Nobody believes me. Everybody thinks I'm stupid or crazy. And I still haven't been able to convince them that, no, it's not crazy, and I feel much happier here. When I went to my first concert here at the House of Blues, it took me like 10 minutes to figure out what was wrong. And then I realized, wow, for once, I can see the stage because there's no smoke, and I can breathe. It was a revelation. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was hoping that I would be able to get a job here in the music business. And it took me quite some time to realize that I won't be able to, because the people who in the business who told me that they're going to help me out, most of them flaked. When you need a job quickly and you need to make some money, you go and work in a restaurant, busboy or anything that they needed to help it. Then I started waiting tables, and so right now I'm a manager. A year after I was here and I was already working at the restaurant, I got an offer from a company in Hungary. The owner came here and said, are you out of your mind? Are you working in a restaurant? I mean, hello? Come back. I want to form a new company, concert promotion. I mean, he gave me an offer that was just stupidly good because he wanted to be sure. And then he was just totally shocked when I told him, you know what, I don't want to go back. It's not the money. I had the money before I left. It's not the money. There's still snow. There's still cigarette smoke everywhere. I got tickets and backstage passes and everything for you too, from the production manager. The show started and I started crying. I was like, damn, I should be on this tour. Because like half the people that were working on this tour, I know them, they're friends of mine. I mean, I was really crying. And then Beautiful Day came on, and I had to stop thinking for a second. I was like, huh, why am I crying about? I mean, Jesus Christ, what are you doing here? You're here in LA, where you want to be. There's no snow, there's no smoking, and you're seeing YouTube for free of charge. Shut up and don't cry.
George Mezzo lives and works in smoke-free L.A. His story was produced by Heidi Pickman. After the break, how Borat has ruined things for foreign documentary filmmakers. That's still ahead here and now. Young, it's here and now. A serious note from the Balkans. This week, the UN's highest court ruled that Serbia was not responsible for genocide in Bosnia. And today, Croatia announced that it might drop a suit against Serbia. Croatia had been seeking reparations, charging that Serbia was responsible for genocide. Well, while that court ruling is having serious reverberations across the region, on a lighter note, a documentary filmmaker from Kosovo has made his way to the U.S. Inspired by the role Americans played in ending the war in his homeland, he came to find out more about the people he considers his liberators. Well, he ran into some stumbling blocks. You see, the premise of his documentary, a crew of foreign filmmakers travels to the U.S. on a cross-country odyssey to document life in America. Sound familiar?
The Ministry of Information decide to make this film about America because we want to be like you. America have most beautiful women in world, for example, Liza Minnelli and Elizabeth Taylor. It also center for democracy and porno. I like!
British actor Sacha Baron Cohen caused quite a controversy with his Borat film. By pretending to be a journalist from Kazakhstan, he managed to get people to reveal some of their ugly prejudices. And so when real-life filmmakers from Kosovo came to the U.S., they found a wary American public. Joining us from New York City is one of those filmmakers, Blerim Josi of Pristina, Kosovo. Welcome.
Thank you.
What did you plan to film in your documentary?
First of all, what we were trying to do was do two documentaries. The first documentary would be about the independent filmmaking in U.S. We wanted to scratch the surface and see what's beneath there. It's not like just the mainstream films and Hollywood films. We wanted to see what other independent filmmakers do in U.S. Mm-hmm. And while we were here, it was the three of us, and we started our stories from Kosovo with the absurdity of having different travel documents and coming from the same town. So we wanted to do another documentary called Us in U.S. or Us in Us or whatever you wanted to call it. And we thought it would be nice by starting with the absurdity of where we come from.
You had trouble getting the travel documents and that's a fun way to launch a film. But then you come to the U.S. and what did you find? I mean, how did people react to you?
When we were with the camera on the street, then everybody was like looking at us weird, in a weird way kind of. And people didn't want to talk with us. And in a couple of occasions, we got people saying like, this is not like Borat. And even when we went to get the visas in the U.S. Embassy in Macedonia over there, the first question was like, is it going to be something like Borat?
Well, we should say, you know, there are a few similarities. Kosovo and Kazakhstan, both parts of the world, people in the U.S. aren't familiar with. I understand you are friends with one of our colleagues. You bear a slight resemblance to Borat. You have the same sort of complexion and sort of curly hair, you know, let's put it that way. And we have a clip of what happened when you went to the airport in Rochester, New York. You spoke to a sky cap there. Let's listen.
You see that man Russian that made that movie? You want to get all these people to be in the movie with him?
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
The Borat?
Now they're all suing them. No, they are. Yeah. They want part of the action. I guess that film made...
That's Borat. Yeah.
That guy made what? I think it was $130 million the first month.
So people, did they think you were Borat or just like Borat?
No, they didn't think I was Borat. They were thinking all the time that we were, you know, something similar, or that movie opened the door for other movies, and it got us really in big trouble because we couldn't do anything with the second part of the film, Us in U.S. So I think we're not going to be able to edit that documentary.
Oh gosh, well, there was another connection apparently, and it has to do with the music that Borat used. It's a connection with Kosovo. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah. When he started doing the Borat, he used this clip, this music clip that would introduce Borat. And that music clip was from a very popular folk singer from Kosovo.
So it's not even Kazakhstan.
No, it's not. It's like from a whole different part of the world. And the singer, the folk singer who owns the song and the rights for the song, he was suing Sasha for taking the music from his album. And it is very funny. And he called it the Kazakh music. And it's in Cyrillic. And Albanians get very much offended by the Cyrillic alphabet because, you know, because of the history, because of the past history with the Serbs. And so he was like double furious on that, and he was trying to sue him, but nothing happened.
Well, let's remind people of that part of the conversation. 90% of the population of Kosovo is made up of ethnic Albanians, some of them Muslims, other Christians, Catholics. You yourself are ethnic Albanian. And the Albanians felt that the U.S. in particular saved them from the Serbs. And so here Borat is using the Serb alphabet, so it's sort of doubly offensive to many Kosovars. And that brings us to, how do Kosovars feel about people from the U.S. and about Americans?
There is a saying over there that is used in Balkans a lot. They say, love your country like Albanians love U.S. Being from America, being from U.S., in Kosovo especially, it's like a bliss, you know. Americans are adored because everybody feels that people are free and return to their homes because of U.S., because of United States of America.
Are some of the ways that Kosovars express that?
In Kosovo, like 4th of July is celebrated as the same way as in U.S., you know, it's big parties and fireworks and stuff like that. And like every holiday in U.S. is also becomes a holiday in Kosovo. Today I got an email from a friend who wants to do a special tribute to American literature at the National Theater. And there's going to be like a permanent American corner at the National Theater there. And a lot of other ways.
Yeah.
And we also produce, for example, we produce a festival, the Remembrance Festival, called the 9-1-1 Fest. It started as a tribute to the victims of the 9-11.
And that's part of what inspired your filmmaking. So here you come to the U.S. expressing, I'm imagining you wanted to express all of these good feelings that Kosovars feel for Americans. What's been your impression of Americans?
Oh, great. I mean, wonderful. I always kind of liked U.S. from the distance. This is my first time ever to visit U.S. And trust me, I'm overwhelmed. Like, I have so many stories I want to go back home and tell to the people and, you know, tell them that it's all true. Almost in every city that we went to L.A., we went to Rochester, and we went to Park City for the Sundance Film Festival, and in New York City, like, everything was so familiar from all the documentaries and from all the pictures that I was looking at. Everything was so familiar. But the greatest moment ever since I got to U.S. was one night I went under the Brooklyn Bridge. And that was like some of my favorite scenes from different films that happened under the bridge. And I took so many pictures. And this is for the first time I felt I did not belong in this world. You know, I was somewhere else. I was floating somewhere. And it feels like I lived here forever. I don't know. It is a very incredible feeling.
You know, given how you feel about the U.S., I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how, you know, many people around the world feel about the U.S. because of what they might perceive as an unsuccessful war in Iraq.
There's a lot of talks about that, and I probably represent most of the Albanians from Kosovo. And I would say that we just pray and we're happy that there is United States of America, and that until there is United States of America, there will be order in this world. And we strongly believe that U.S. had a big reason to intervene there. And I don't think that wars and miracles don't happen within a week. You know, it takes time for these things to get resolved. And as I can see in U.S., the only thing that actually surprised me was that the people are always in a hurry. They even have their coffees on like while walking, and they want things to happen so fast. And in wars, and when there is these ethnic hatred conflicts, you know, things don't go on that fast. It takes time. It takes time for things to settle. It takes time to find a resolution. So if any of Americans want to hear my opinion, I would say, like, these things take time, you know, give it a time.
Larim Josi, a filmmaker from Kosovo, speaking to us from New York City on his great adventure here. Larim, thanks so much.
You're more than welcome.
And to see photographs of Larim Josi's visit to the U.S., go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.